Welcome back to Leads to Scale, a podcast from Social Media Week. I am your host, Toby Daniels. On this week's episode, we have Victor Pinheiro, SVP of Social Media at Big Spaceship, a digital agency based in Brooklyn, New York. Victor leads the social practice at Big Spaceship and has worked with clients including YouTube, Magic Leap, JetBlue, Google Maps, and Starbucks. During our conversation, we talked about Big Spaceship's capabilities, how they think about the intersection of culture and human behavior, and what social media trends marketers should be paying attention to. I really enjoyed this conversation with Victor, and I hope you do too. On the podcast today, we have Victor Pinheiro, SVP of Social Media at Big Spaceship. Welcome to the show, Victor.
Thank you for having me.
All right. First up, tell our listeners a little bit about you and what Big Spaceship is, and also a little bit about your role.
Absolutely. So I head up social and content at Big Spaceship. Big Spaceship's a digital agency. We call ourselves a modern partner or a partner for modern brands these days. About 20 years old now. And I kind of head up everything in the worlds of social media, everything in the world of content, from YouTube to Hasbro to a lot of different Google brands to JetBlue. We have our fingers in a lot of really interesting pots right now.
So you, I've known you for a few years, and I know a little bit about your background. I mean, you're like a content guy, an editorial guy, I suppose, first and foremost, which has sort of led you to what you're doing now at Big Spaceship. But just give us a little bit of background. Like, what led you to the social media world and specifically the role that you have right now?
Yeah, it's been a weird path and a really fun one, honestly. It all started when my brother and I decided to make a documentary about virtual worlds. So we made this documentary way back in 2009, exploring places like Second Life, World of Warcraft, places where people kind of live these alternate lives online. And, you know, we just really geeked out on the idea of these different subcultures and these communities and emergent behaviors that you would see on these platforms. And so what ended up happening is that led really neatly into social media. And because our documentary got a lot of press within these circles, when I kind of made the jump from documentaries, Big Spaceship had me come in kind of as a social media guy. So it really started and continues to be kind of community and fandom centric, which I think is great, because I do think a lot of times, like I definitely think people kind of consider me an editorial content guy. And I think the other half of that is kind of a fandom guy as well.
Tell us more about what you mean. I mean, fandom is generally sort of a term that's applies to the kind of the entertainment world and probably the sort of the comic book world. Mm-hmm. But tell us more about fandom and where sort of fandom sort of fits into social media from your point of view.
Absolutely. I think, I think in terms of fandoms and very kind of passionate communities, I think that's always been the thread that I found most fascinating about all of this. So I think, you know, take it back to the video games. And in that world, I think it's what you're talking about. These fandoms are very entertainment based. They're based on certain properties, certain IPs, and people geeking out about them and forming really strong bonds around them. I think as you get into social media, I think fandoms are fascinating, because I think when you really slice and dice a few of these bigger platforms, what you find are really a few core fandoms at the core. You know, I think it's been so fascinating to see how Twitter's audience has evolved over the years. And I think where it was 5 years ago, or even longer, I think it's so different than where it is right now, where a lot of what you see on Twitter are very, very rabid entertainment fandoms, meeting journalists, and meeting stand-up comedians, and kind of some mishmash of all of those, and everyone else kind of at the sides watching it all. I think a lot of social platforms right now have core fandoms that kind of drive a lot of their content, and also drive a lot of the most passionate aspects of those platforms.
It's interesting when you think about the evolution of the actual technologies that have supported the kind of the communities that form the fandom that sort of forms around kind of like certain entertainment properties. We have obviously experienced a huge amount of change in the last 10 to 20 years. Take us back to when you started to kind of engage within these like communities. What were the different tools and technologies that you were using back then? And then sort of bring us kind of up to speed in terms of what have been the most important technology platforms that have kind of like shaped that world, during that time.
Absolutely. I think, when you kind of think back, there's been so many different platforms that have come and gone and kind of modes of communication. I think when it all kind of started, really, I think blogging was the first major social network, or whatever you want to call it. And I think really a lot of what was happening that we consider social marketing and kind of social communities, they lived and died on blogs, and they lived and died on forums. And what's been really interesting is kind of seeing how that kind of blogging and forum, those were kind of the building blocks for a lot of what we see nowadays. So I think that even though, you know, that's what there were, things were thriving at that point. I think Twitter was really a very big step for all this, because I think you had Friendster, you had MySpace, you even had Facebook, but none of those really had that interesting kind of like democratization of communication amongst everybody, where Twitter was, you could jump in there and talk to anybody in the world who had a Twitter platform, even though it was in these teeny tiny bursts that, you know, we still had the ability to have these enormous conversations as kind of a planet. And then also, I think it was just fascinating in that it gave everybody a little bit of a stage, and it kind of gave them a platform to talk, converse, share, you know, all those things.
Right. I mean, like, if you think about it, like the mid-2000s, I mean, back then I happened to be working for a company that was looking very closely at, like, how do you provide the social networking sort of functionality around, like, you know, big entertainment properties. And at the time we were looking very closely at what these entertainment properties had already built on their own platforms, like forums, basically, right, which were sort of serving as a way to connect around like a TV show, a way to kind of create a thread or connect around a specific conversation related to a TV show. Yeah. And we were just simply looking like, how can we improve upon this particular experience? While obviously there were sort of things emerging in regards to kind of like, you know, Friendster and MySpace. But I think, as you say, Twitter was just like so interesting in terms of how that kind of exploded, and in particular, and I think was just sort of built into the original kind of like Twitter product, was this idea that you could take it, run with it, adapt it, build things kind of on top of it or integrate with it that would then support how these communities were engaging online. Talk a little bit more about your kind of early sort of experience with Twitter. And, you know, I love to have this conversation because, you know, we definitely like to poke holes at the platforms a little bit. And it's interesting to sort of see how Twitter has evolved and how it continues to serve a lot of this kind of like behavior online. But take us back and talk about, like, you know, Twitter in the early days for you and how it's evolved since then.
Absolutely. I think your example is really interesting too, because I think it's a great example of how I think in the past a lot of entertainment companies felt that they own those communities, that the, you know, there's communities that we own and we're the gatekeepers, and, you know, you can geek out on our about our IP, you can geek out about our characters and our worlds and our whatever it might be, but it's on our terms. And I think Twitter was the first one to really disintermediate that. Mm-hmm. But early Twitter is fantastic, because I think, you know, my first you know, I had this amazing first opportunity when social media marketing was just kind of starting to gain a little bit of steam, in that I was able to bring Skittles to social media, which was this fantastic experience. And what was so interesting about it was that back then, you know, we're talking 2009, Twitter and Facebook were really platforms for one-liners, and that was it. This was text only. This was, you know, how much could you fit in 140 characters with no assets, with no media? It was really just one-liner by one-liner, and you were having, you know, these really interesting, very short, quick conversations with this very quickly growing community. And I think that's what was so great about Twitter, because I think Twitter to me was so inscrutable by so many people when it first started. You know, it was these people thought, wait, am I supposed to tell people when I brush my teeth? Do I just tell people every time I eat a meal? Why am I giving people these updates? And I think people, it was really a curveball for a lot of people when they first saw it. And I think that's why Twitter, it exploded in growth amongst kind of a pretty large subculture, but I think the wider culture, it took so long for them to adopt it. And I know, you know, over the last 5-6 years, there's been so many conversations about, why is Twitter struggling to grow as quickly as these other platforms? Well, it's still a little bit indecipherable to a lot of people.
Right, right. It's interesting. I mean, like, one of the reasons why I think Instagram kind of, you know, sort of stepped into the space and grew so quickly and ultimately became a much, much more significant property was because it addressed or solved one of the biggest kind of challenges that Twitter faced then and in many ways continues to face in regards to kind of like its UI. I mean, it is kind of garbled nonsense, right? Yeah. When you actually look at, if anyone who had never experienced Twitter before and said, this is the way that hundreds of millions of people consume information online, you look at the actual kind of like underlying sort of information, you think, this makes no sense. Why this is not evolution. We have not seem to have advanced from a communication standpoint in any meaningful way. And you know, I always remember actually when Flipboard came out, and Flipboard did this amazing job of like sort of taking like that sort of like raw Twitter sort of information and then turning it into something really beautiful that felt more like a magazine. And it's like, it blows my mind that they sort of missed that opportunity and didn't step into the visual communication space kind of more aggressively and really address a lot of the reasons why people just struggle with Twitter as this kind of like, you know, complex code that has to be sort of deciphered.
Absolutely. I think that's dead on. And I think it's funny, you know, complex code is a great word for it, because I think so much of that came about, I think, in the behaviors that kind of emerged early on, where, you know, hashtags were a thing, and then at mentioning people. And I think now Twitter's gotten a little bit better about kind of guiding you to like the different components of a tweet. But back then it was like you throw a hashtag over here and an at symbol here and here, and people have no idea what's going on. There's three words that I can tell you, I understand what they mean, and the rest of this is just gobbledygook. So
right, yeah, totally. Yeah, no, it's interesting. So, you know, bring us up to speed in regards to kind of like the capabilities of Big Spaceship today in terms of what you do in the sort of the social media landscape and how you're servicing your clients.
Yeah, and I think that's you know, just kind of been a really interesting case of where a lot of agencies are. We're just riding the evolution of social and digital over the last, you know, 10 years. And I think with us, what was really great is, you know, so we had that Skittles experience way back in 2009. And we were doing social for a lot of different brands for the next few years. But I think in late 2012, YouTube approached us about writing some tweets for them. And it grew really quickly. And that became, you know, so we became the social agency of record for YouTube. And that was an amazing way for us to grow our social practice, because it meant cutting your teeth on a brand that at once was incredibly vital. So, you know, everything we were posting had to be just a few hours old. There was no planning content for the daily social stuff. It had to be very culturally of the moment. So we had to find people who really spoke, you know, internet ease, like spoke the language of the internet moment by moment, day by day. So it meant finding very culturally attuned people. And eventually, you know, 2 years into our journey with them, influencers exploded. And I think, you know, the article I always remember that was kind of, I see it as the birth of influencer marketing, was when Variety had this big article that showed that, oh, people under 18 recognize these 10 YouTube stars before they recognize one Hollywood star. And I think everybody over the age of 34 went, oh my God, what the heck is this? Like, who are these YouTube stars? And it was this amazing luxury to be in the middle of that as it was happening and to help build out a lot of these huge influencers on YouTube. So I think our capability is there. So to your earlier point, it started very editorially focused. A lot of it was about cultural curation and about creating a lot of different content. A lot of it was text and image based. And I think what we've really grown into in the last few years has been, you know, rather than looking at it as content that's created specifically for social that kind of like, you know, pays off all the different behaviors and culture on social, I think it's creating much larger campaigns and finding the right way to translate them into social, digital, whatever, you mm-hmm. know, those different platforms might be.
Big Spaceship has always like struck me as an agency that's like very much kind of like in touch with what's happening culturally as part of the kind of the broader sort of social media zeitgeist, and also in terms of kind of understanding sort of behaviors, particularly among kind of like younger generations. You know, you mentioned earlier on at the top of the show that you're a modern partner to Ambitious Brands. What does being a modern partner mean, but in the context of how Big Spaceship stays so culturally relevant?
Yeah, you hit on the two biggest words. So I think what we always come back to, and I think what's kind of let us, you know, survive and thrive for so long in the chaotic world of digital social, is we always bring it back to culture and behavior. Everything to us is, you know, don't be hypnotized by a new platform. Don't be hypnotized by a new technology. Take a look at how people are using that platform, whether it's, you know, specific behaviors you find on it, or in the larger sense, how does it fit into culture and how are people using that culturally? So I think where that's really helped us a lot is in hiring, in terms of hiring. So I think your perception is exactly what I share that. I think what we try to do is we try to hire very culturally sensitive, culturally in tune people so that we can really be speaking to an audience that we feel confident that we're talking their language, we're sharing content that they find interesting, and we're staying on top of all of that. So what we call it all of the times is hiring people that are native to a certain culture. So for example, for the longest time, my content team was not primarily marketers. They were primarily comedians and journalists, and we had some writers, and it was people who were already kind of shoulders deep in culture versus people who had a ton of marketing experience. Because we found that, especially with the clients that we were, you know, managing, still are, but I think in 2014 to 2016, we had a lot of different clients that were very entertainment based. There were a lot of technology companies. Everybody wanted to talk to millennials or maybe even Gen Z. So to your point, it was really important that first and foremost, we were people who could communicate to millennials and Gen Z and make it feel like we were part of their communities, we were joining their communities, and we weren't just talking at them.
I'm loath to talk about this, but like, because I get this question a lot, and to a certain extent it frustrates me, but I would actually be really interested to kind of hear your perspective on this. So social media, the sort of catch-all term for everything that is like happening in the sort of interconnected world of how information is shared online, kind of gets a little bit of a bad rap, or at least it's a sort of a term at the moment that raises a lot of kind of questions and eyebrows and criticisms and what have you. However, you wear the social media term in regards to your own title and in terms of how you describe your capabilities as an agency with pride. So can you talk about that? Like, do you care? Do you pay much attention to the criticisms and the pushback and the backlash that we're all experiencing now? Or are you sort of just very comfortable with social media in terms of how it relates to what you do?
That's a great question. Incredibly timely, right?
And very long, by the way. I'm very sort of conscious of that. It was a long question.
No. I'll try to make a long answer, but it's a good one, right? It's quite meaty right now. So yes, I think every day we read that social media is the fall of society and it's leading to our dooms. And I see that. I think right now we're in one of those funny best of times, worst of times situation where a lot of what we're celebrating about social media are exactly the same things that make it dangerous and scary to people. So, you know, you look at it from one angle and it's very kind of optimistic angle, and social media is the great connector, and, you know, we're connected more deeply than we ever have before. And now with targeting, we can really do a great job of giving people exactly the content that they want at the moment they want it. And we're really fulfilling their needs and giving them things that are going to make their lives better, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then you flip that and it's everything else we're talking about in the world right now. And I think the more prevalent stories right now are everything around privacy concerns and what we're seeing, you know, in terms of hacking and in terms of how politics have completely been reformed. And then you look at bullies and you look at the idea that, you know, mob behavior is so prevalent online because it can be because we're anonymous. So all of which is to say, I think it's an incredibly loaded word, but I do think social media, it's becoming more and more, you know, integral and intrinsic to everything we do. So I do think that even though we're getting a bad rep and there's a lot of PR headlines around it, and I think there's a lot of validity to what we're criticizing it about, I think ultimately it's just the way that people communicate right now, you know, and we've seen it, right? We've seen it started out as this broadcast-only platform where it was very simple. It was Twitter and Facebook and very simple messages into the world of dark social and one-on-one messages and the idea of, you know, all these different smaller communities talking to each other. Then we got into ephemerality. I think there's so many different ways to cut it, but right now it is the major way that we're all speaking to each other on this earth. So like it or not, it's the web, it's the fabric.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we were just talking about this before we started the show, and our theme in 2019 for Social Media Week is stories with great influence comes great responsibility. And it speaks to, I think, the idea that, you know, we've built audiences, massive audiences, audiences that are dwarfing kind of like traditional TV-sized audiences through social media. And as content creators and as brands and especially as the platforms, we have to recognize the responsibility that comes with that, that comes with being able to engage with and potentially influence such large audiences. And the key message that we want to sort of definitely communicate and part of a set of questions that we want to ask throughout the next year relates to this idea that we are a product of what we consume. It shapes who we are and ultimately what we become, and we've seen that play out in so many different ways. But what's really interesting to me is that the social media has helped to raise up both the good and the bad aspects of society and societal behaviors that were not necessarily behaviors that didn't necessarily not exist in the past, but behaviors that are now amplified as a result of these new mediums and these new ways to kind of connect and communicate.
Yeah.
And so we sort of think about like the future, and we think about our roles and responsibilities as an industry. What do you think we should be thinking about? What do you think that we should be working on to sort of move forward in the most positive way possible?
That's a huge one. I think the first thing that we have to start figuring out how to solve is the mob mentality on social media. Honestly, I think it's you know, the idea that everybody kind of has a scarlet letter when they say something badly on social media and they're crucified for it and there's an angry mob, and that, you know, a lot of people use social as an excuse to be hysterical about a lot of things rather than having kind of a more kind of a mediated discussion. You know, I think my favorite social platform is Reddit, and I think, as at least right now it is, and I think one of the main reasons is because they have moderators, and you look at a lot of these really heated discussions they have. For example, that the subreddit on politics is fascinating to me because it's the only place I've seen a very civil conversation about some really difficult topics about politics. It's the only place that I'm seeing a real conversation on that, where it's not just talking heads or whatever it might be. Maybe Twitter is the medium where people are just screaming at each other and going on these tirades, and it's all about bullying and mob mentality. So that would be the first thing. I think that's a really difficult topic or subject to begin with, obviously.
Let me ask you how you address that from your client's perspective, because I imagine that they are just increasingly becoming more fearful of doing anything in the social space, you know, given how quickly they could be like eviscerated, or how quickly the mob can kind of jump on anything that they might do, whether they're misconstruing it or whether they are just simply straight out like criticizing it. So what guardrails or measures what guardrails and measures do you try and put in place to provide some level of confidence that, you know, your clients are not going to get just completely destroyed in social media?
I mean, brand safety, I think, is one of the biggest issues we're facing the last year, for sure. I think, you know, every brand has that fear. Every brand is terrified to make the wrong move.
Do you define brand safety as simply like a brand and it's like proximity to something inappropriate, or do you also define it as ensuring that the even like down to the campaign level, what you put out there, the brand is protected somehow against the potential kind of mob mentality?
Yeah, I honestly think it's both. I think in general, the issue is a brand, you know, brands are often asking like, how can we be as provocative as we can be to get attention, grow brand love, grow sentiment, whatever that might be, while at the same time balancing with that, with the fact that we don't want to get eviscerated, we don't want that mob mentality. And I think a lot of times, honestly, the best, you know, I haven't really thought this through before, but I think it's interesting. I think the best way to be sure that you're on the right side of, you know, the right side of history with whatever you're posting is having a very diverse team that's very culturally attuned. Because I think over and over again, you know, obviously the super famous example is Pepsi. And the idea there was, well, maybe brands should hire agencies so that they have a second pair of eyes in the room. But I think the larger insight there is that you need people who, you know, have dealt with being marginalized, who have dealt with being part of different subcultures, who have dealt with, you know, misogyny, whatever that might be, because they're the ones that can tell you like, hey, I know the brand means well with this, but right now this isn't going to work because X, Y, and Z. And I think it also takes people who are very inside social culture and inside internet culture to understand, hey, this is a hot button issue right now, or this word that you think you know what it means, you know, to quote The Princess Bride, you don't know what it means. This means something completely different.
This week's Lead to Scale podcast is brought to you by our very own Social Media Week New York 2019. I'm incredibly excited to announce that the 11th edition of SMW NYC will take place between April 30th and May 2nd at the Sheraton Times Square Hotel in New York City. I'm super excited to share with you our 2019 theme, Stories. With great influence comes great responsibility, which will explore how the content we create and consumes shapes who we are and what we become. Visit socialmediaweek.org/New York and secure your pass today. And if you use the code LEADS2SCALE, you will receive an additional 10% off your pass. Now let's get back to the show. Just building off of what you were just talking about, just give an example maybe of a campaign that you're particularly proud of where you've worked with a client, launched something, executed on something that A, you feel proud of, but also speaks to kind of like the brand safety kind of part of what we were just discussing.
Yeah, I think I would, so the one that I really like is the Get Out the Vote campaign we did with YouTube for the 2016 election. It's a couple years old now, but I think because, you know, we've been YouTube social agency for almost 7 years now, that to me was kind of the highlight of it. And I think it's a good example of brand safety. So the short version is, YouTube wanted to get out the vote message. YouTube wanted to kind of, you know, help push people to register, to vote, to take part in politics for a minute. And a lot of other brands were getting into the game at that point, of course, but there were also a lot of other social platforms that were getting very involved. Facebook did, you know, had a huge Get Out the Vote campaign. Snapchat had one that got a lot of headlines. And YouTube had a really interesting challenge in that it has three different levels of people on the platform. There are the there's the celebrities who are on YouTube and the celebrities that want to be on YouTube. Then there's the creators, the famous creators who are kind of celebrities unto themselves, but their success is endemic to the platform. And then there's four. Then there's the minor and up and coming creators. And then there's just the fans who are just watching content on YouTube. And so what we were trying to do is, how do we have a campaign that speaks to all four of those and actually leverages all four of those different communities to help push people to get out the vote? So what we decided is we needed a call to action that was incredibly easy to do and very high reward, so that we could ask a celebrity to do something that only took them a minute to do, but then we could ask a smaller creator that if you want to be, you know, if you want your video placed next to a celebrity's, you know, you can blow out this idea and kind of, you know, if yours is good enough, then we'll put you next to theirs. And what it came down to was we did some research and found that it takes a minute and 34 seconds to register to vote. So our CTA was, do whatever you want for a minute and 34 seconds on your video and link to these registration tools and entertain them as they register. And that was it. So what that meant was, you know, when Conan O'Brien or The Rock, we had a bunch of different celebrities kind of took part or share, they all did very idiosyncratic, quick things that took them all of 94 seconds. You know, somebody filmed them on a camera. I think Conan O'Brien's was the best. He literally just put popcorn in the microwave, and as it popped, he spoke to people about registering to vote. Where on the other end, we decked out a lot of different YouTube studios to look like the president of the Oval Office, and we brought a lot of people into the studios, and they created these really amazing 94-second videos that were really great to watch. And we interwove all of them on a playlist, and that ended up getting tons and tons of views, tons and tons of engagement, because it was interesting on a lot of different levels, and a lot of different people got really excited about it, and they were all kind of posting it to their communities, and it kind of grew exponentially from there. But all of that is to say, that's a space that's incredibly fraught and incredibly dangerous. You know, politics, obviously, as far away from brand safety as you can get if you do it the wrong way. So what was most important to us was completely take a step back and say, YouTube is the community's platform. We'll let you talk about politics and talk about, you know, we want to focus on registration. We want to focus on the positivity of registering and voting. We're not going to get into the politics, but we're not going to say anything. We're going to let our community speak for themselves. And I think that is an approach that we've taken since to a lot of different YouTube campaigns, where it's completely told, you know, in the voices and with the footage and content from our community, and we're not saying anything ourselves.
You touched on The Rock, so I want to take an opportunity to talk about him, but also celebrities and the sort of broader influencer space in general. I mean, obviously, celebrities jumped, you know, onto social media sort of pretty early. They recognized that it was an incredible and very direct channel to their you know, to their audiences and to their fans. That has obvious positive upsides and has also, you know, been fairly disastrous for them on a number of different levels at the same time. But I think providing them with the tools and the control and the means to communicate directly with their fans has been really interesting and exciting to see, you know, develop over the last like few years. What's your sort of general assessment, though, of the influencer space, particularly as like a category or a channel for marketers? Talk about, within that question, talk about some of the positives and also some of the negatives.
Yeah, I think my hot take on that is I think that we are months away from Facebook doing a really big job of bursting the influencer marketing bubble. Mm-hmm. You know, I haven't actually seen a ton of articles on this, which I find fascinating, but Facebook has talked a little bit about having a feature where, so first things first, you know, I think influencers, so social media was the Wild West for like 5 or 6 years until Facebook kind of pulled the lever and all of a sudden the algorithm shifted and you had to pay to play. And I think the next Wild West became influencers, and influencers was this amazing Wild West where you didn't have to pay a ton of money to get eyeballs, and it was kind of this back channel to getting a lot of eyeballs, to getting really passionate fans, you know, who have really amazing advocates, to look at your brand, to love your brand, to buy from your brand, whatever it might be. And we've all seen, you know, the end of the Wild West for influencers coming, where, you know, it's become much more legally troublesome when an influencer doesn't disclose that a post is sponsored. But what that is all leading to is a world where, you know, we've seen it start on Instagram, but we're going to see it on Facebook as well, where if any influencer you know, kind of marks one of his posts as being sponsored or in any way having a tie to a brand that paid them, then Facebook is going to kill all reach on that post unless the brand pays for it. And I think that's going to be have a huge ripple effect across all of influencer marketing, because what we've been getting with influencer marketing has been two sides, right? There's been the fact that you get absolute amazing reach, and there's been the fact that you get this great presence that has people very passionate around them that people trust, and all of a sudden the reach is going to go away and it's going to become much more like a celebrity endorsement where you're literally just paying for that celebrity and you're paying the media to get that celebrity in front of other people's eyeballs, and all you're getting from that is the advocacy angle and the trust. You're not getting the reach. I think that's going to have a huge effect on influencer marketing in the near future.
Do you think that is a bad thing? And I'll play devil's advocate for a second, but I interviewed Paul Kontonis, the CMO of Husay, recently, and he said, sure, organic reach is in decline, but that's okay. The Wild West, you know, affords you an opportunity to test and experiment and build audience, you know, organically. But there is always ultimately going to be a price that you have to pay at some point down the line. So we have to accept that if we are going to sort of take advantage of all of these various different sort of free tools and platforms. But one of the things that he said that I thought was very interesting was that, like, what's important is that whatever audience an influencer, a creator, a celebrity has built is a proxy to the type of content that they create. And so whatever audience you ultimately buy against in terms of being able to achieve the kind of reach that the brand would expect, it's then subsequently much easier to be able to think about who we should be targeting based on the proxy audience that the influencer or creator has already established. So a two-part question, really. One, just in general, do you think that, like, organic reach being in decline is necessarily a bad thing? And when you say popping the bubble, do you really just mean this is just a transitional step? And then, you know, when you think about, you know, paid as a layer that sits on top of organic, is this just not the natural way forward?
Yeah, I think absolutely. So I do think, and I suppose bursting the bubble might sound dramatic, but the reason I use the language is I felt it felt very much the same way in 2013 when it happened with, you know, organic reach on all social. But I think you're right. Ultimately, it is an evolution of the form. It is an evolution of influencers. I think, you know, I think what's going to be interesting to me is I see it coming. I see how it has to evolve. And, you know, we've seen that for a couple of years. To me, the ball is now going to be in the brand's court in terms of, is it still worthwhile for you to take on influencers? And then if influencers are now more about, you know, like you were saying, the proxy audience, more about having that fan base that's very in tune with them, that'll buy whatever they sell, is that still valuable enough for you to have a strong influencer piece of your marketing mix? Or are you going to start relying on other aspects as well? So I do think it's an evolution. I completely agree with you. And it's inevitable. It's always inevitable. This is always where things go with any algorithm-based, you know, media platform. But I'm either concerned or curious to see how brands react and what the next influencer marketing phase is. You know, how does it change things when, you know, in some cases, only bigger brands who have bigger budgets are able to command these influencers' attention and use them in different campaigns.
Outside of that space, what are some of the other emerging industry trends that you're either curious or concerned about?
Oh, that's a good one. I definitely think the influencer is one of the biggest ones. I think, let's see, industry trends that I'm curious about.
I can sort of, let me rephrase it slightly, yeah, because I want to go back to actually something that is really kind of core to Big Spaceship. You talked about culture and behavior. What are some of the kind of emerging behaviors that you think are interesting for us to be sort of paying attention to that, to a certain extent, can sort of form some kind of like emerging trend that marketers should be aware of?
Yeah, I think the obvious one, the one that I think is really should be getting all of our attention right now, and to some extent it is, and that's one of the reasons I like the title of your next social media week, is I think stories are the biggest thing right now, right? I think stories are the most important foundational element, because I think stories, and what I mean obviously is what started with Snapchat and then got, you know, borrowed by Instagram, and you know, Instagram did this amazing job of blowing out even more. That to me is the perfect shape of media at the moment, given the way that we behave on our phones, given the form factor of a phone, and given the culture around how we are expressive with each other. So I think to me the most interesting thing now is seeing the evolution of stories. First, it was the evolution from going from a Snapchat into an Instagram, you know, going from a platform like Snapchat, which was seen almost more as a communications tool than a social platform, into a platform that is very clearly a little bit more of a traditional social platform. I think seeing this interesting mix with stories between broadcast social media and ephemeral social media, and just getting a sense of how this is all going to continue evolving, you know, as Instagram keeps adding different aspects to it, as Facebook takes stories as they have and kind of, you know, might morph it into a slightly different beast given the platform. And, you know, we have so many other different platforms. There's so many jokes about what platform is going to take the stories format and use it next. So I think that to me as a, not only as a new shape for media, but also as a new playground for creative minds to play on, I think is really interesting.
Which platforms do you think should not adopt the stories format?
Ooh, that's a good one. I think right now, to me, my favorite meme around it was when somebody posted about Excel having Excel stories, which I thought was great.
I was thinking like LinkedIn as well, but you know, yes. Do we necessarily want to sort of see the inside of someone's like office and sort of the day in life of you know, person X in their office and doing their job? Probably not.
I would love LinkedIn to bring it out for a little while, only because you're right, it would be so dystopian that I would love to see what that looked like, LinkedIn stories.
Right, exactly. Okay, so let's transition again and look a little bit sort of further into the future. And I'm always interested to ask this question, not in just a kind of like, you know, future forecasting, kind of what are your 8 big trends for like 2019? Because I think, you know, we're all probably, there are probably enough of those out there at the moment already. But instead, like from a very personal standpoint, what are you most excited about in terms of like where some of this is sort of heading in the future? And not just from a sort of the perspective of Victor, the kind of like the SVP of social media at Big Spaceship, but Victor, the user of social media, like what are you excited about that's emerging today that you think is going to have a sort of big impact on things in the future?
Yeah, I think what's been interesting, and you know, I think you know, we've both been in social for a long time, and I think you know, for the longest time I used to write a social trends piece at the end of the year for Ad Age for a few years, and it was always interesting because I think if you keep studying it year after year, what happens is, like you said, you get the same 5 or 6 trends in some different form, and that those always carry through year to year, and they're always the same, and it's fascinating that people continue to post them as the next big thing. Then you get certain technologies which come and go, and there's always one per year, and I feel like almost none of them have ever branched out. So I'm going to say 2 years ago it was chatbots, then the year before that it was VR, and then you know every year there was something like that. So I think it's good to pivot it just to what people like us geek out about. I think right now it's an interesting moment. I think you know what's interesting about it is a lot of, whereas there used to be, you could argue, 5 to 9 social platforms that were all kind of had really interesting roles in the world, it's really pared down to just 2 or 3 vital social platforms. And I mourn the death of Vine like anybody else and in some of these other kind of niche social platforms. But as we're getting into a world where there's fewer of them, it's really about the most interesting thing in a lot of ways is how people are telling stories on them, and also how platforms are very quickly evolving to allow us to tell different stories on them. So I think that's really interesting. I think right now, the article that really kind of blew my mind from this summer was there's this great New York Times piece talking about how the most popular job for teenagers this year is not, you know, working at a retail store or working at McDonald's or working at wherever it might be. A lot of teenagers are doing tiny influencer deals with brands to make their way through the summer. So, any teen who has, you know, is pretty popular in high school, they might have 1,000 or a couple thousand followers, they're able to ask brand X, Y, and Z, hey, if you send me some clothes, fashion, lip gloss, whatever it might be, I'll post about it, pay me this nominal amount of money, and I'll be your influencer. And a lot of them were doing that. So to me, it's like, okay, if we're in a world now where everybody either wants to be an influencer or already is a micro influencer, then where does that take things? What does that mean if we're all the celebrity right now? So that to me, it's not something I'm looking forward to so much as just curious right. As to where that's heading.
Yeah, I know. I read similar things and have seen that emerge certainly. And look, it could very well just be a phase, or it could just be an evolutionary kind of step, and perhaps teenagers as they grow older and become young adults, just naturally seek out kind of the same deeper and more meaningful connections, or the same deeper and more meaningful kind of stories that we all tend to want to seek out, and leave those kind of slightly more either narcissistic behaviors behind, which, you know, may inevitably be the case.
Right.
You know, and the other thing that we were talking about earlier, which I think is worth touching on, is this sort of this idea that, you know, there is a really sort of shitty end of the spectrum in terms of what social media represents, and there's a really incredible end of the spectrum in terms of what social media represents, and there's obviously like everything that exists between, but that's no different to broadcast media, or really it's not that much different to any other form of communication that was like enabled by technology in the past. There will be terrible uses of it and incredible uses of it, and at the end of the day, that's okay. But what I think is important as we move forward and as we think about the future is how can we connect to the things that matter, to the things that really mean something to us at a fundamental human level, because that is ultimately going to shape us and be part of the kind of the human experience. You know, as we grow older, the more time we spend connecting to things that matter, the more enriched and more fulfilled I imagine we will become. And that seems to be kind of like an important thing as content creators, and even as like marketers and storytellers, that we should be sort of thinking about and obviously taking very seriously.
Yeah, I think that's enormously true. And I think that, you know, and a lot of that, there's the one aspect I think that is how much of that is going to be based on, you know, the algorithm or the filter bubble that we have for each of us, and how much of us can take an active role in making sure that hopefully our content diet, you know, something you were saying earlier, is more responsible or enriching, or you know, a bit more fulfilling. And hopefully we can be a little bit more responsible with our content diet, or the algorithms can help us be more responsible with it, whatever that might be. Then maybe the word social media will be a little bit less triggering to people.
Got it.
You know? And I think, you know, to your earlier point, I think what's interesting right now in terms of the future of social, I think what's very frustrating is, you know, and I'd imagine you're in a similar boat, is what I'm really looking forward to in social, it's kind of proven to me that that's still 5 years away at least, where it's, I'm waiting for, so, you know, all the way back when I started, back in 2006, when my brother and I were looking at virtual worlds, we thought, wow, okay, here's the first example of a real life virtual world and people living in it and people kind of, you know, this crazy social experiment. When is that going to happen in a way, you know, when is that going to hit AR or VR or whatever that might be? And that's what I'm waiting for. I'm waiting for that, you know, inevitable moment that seems to be further and further away every time we start kind of prognosticating about it, where social media is fused with AR and VR, and all of a sudden the world looks very, very different. And that to me is fascinating, but it isn't tomorrow, and I desperately wish that it was.
I'd love to leave it there, but I actually have one more sort of fairly self-serving question to ask, and it would be remiss of me not to kind of talk about this. Obviously, Victor, you have been a regular at Social Media Week. Yeah. You presented not just at our New York conference, but I believe also in LA as well. And I wanted to ask, you know, when you think about your business, scaling your business, which is something that we do spend a bit of time talking about on this podcast, I'd always interested to kind of hear your thoughts in terms of like why conferences like Social Media Week, and you don't have to necessarily sort of talk about or reference us, of course, but why is it important? How does it benefit you as a business in terms of like how you continue to sort of stay sharp, but also in terms of how you continue kind of scale your business and even like acquire new clients?
Yeah, and I think there's three things, and I will be specific to Social Media Week, because I think I've been there for, I've done quite a few of them and I love them, and I think it's a really fascinating set of people that kind of are brought together with Social Media Week. So to me, the first obvious one is connections. And everybody knows that's why you go to conferences, obviously, to make these amazing connections, whether it's with potential clients, whether it's with other people in your industry, whether it's with vendors. It's just a, you know, great platform to speak to all of them, to figure out which ones are the most valuable, to figure out which ones you vibe with, and go from there. So that of course. The one that I think is more interesting to me, and it's something that started a couple of years ago when we started doing collaborative talks at Social Media Week. You know, I did one with YouTube, and you know, another one the other last year as well. And I think what's great about that is that gives you such a great canvas to get really, gives you a different canvas to kind of, you know, play with your clients. And it allows you to be creative, and it allows you to really kind of figure out how you want to work together on thinking about whether it's social media or digital or marketing at large. And it really helps kind of sharpen the way that you think about it and the way that you know, you and your client are communicating about it. So I think it's this fantastic tool for collaboration and to get kind of a have a deeper relationship with a lot of your clients, and it leads to a stronger relationship, and it leads to, I think, much longer term work with that client, which is great. And the third one, which I don't think is said enough either, is there are very few, especially in our industry, especially when it's, you know, when it's an agency, but often I also think a lot of brands and a lot of digital and social teams, there isn't a lot of time to step back and kind of question, how do I see the world of digital, of social, of marketing, of whatever it might be? What's that holistic view I have of it? What are my opinions on it, and how is it changing? We really don't get a ton of opportunities to do that. And I think, you know, conferences like Social Media Week are the best opportunity to do that, because you have to step back. You have to think about it holistically. You have to think, what is my point of view on something? And then, you know, the great thing is it always starts with a talk. So that talk, all of a sudden you might have a deck that you created for it or a presentation. But that presentation, you then slice it up and you have all this great content that's going to serve you for a few extra months. So I kind of see it working on three different levels. And that's why I really enjoy talking there year after year.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. And yeah, of course, we appreciate having you and hosting you at Social Media Week. And long may that continue. Victor, this has been wonderful. Thanks so much for joining us here on the podcast. Where can people find out more information about you, Victor, on social media, and then also Big Spaceship?
Sure. I'm on Twitter and Instagram as Victor Pinheiro, and Big Spaceship, just bigspaceship.com. And we're also quite active on Instagram and Twitter.
Wonderful. Thanks again, Victor.
Thank you.
This has been Leads to Scale, brought to you by Social Media Week. For more information on how to get involved with future events, visit socialmediaweek.org. If you have a moment, please rate, review, and subscribe to Leads to Scale wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks so much for listening.